This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. On the television show Star Trek, the crew's mission, of course, was to boldly go where no man had gone before. But who would have thought that the Internal Revenue Service would get involved?
These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise-wide. Its never-ending mission is to seek out new tax forms, to explore strange new regulations, to boldly go where no government employee has gone before.
That's a clip from the 2010 Star Trek spoof created by the IRS. Actually, CBS revealed that $60,000 film after filing a Freedom of Information Act request. Critics were a little upset that it was a clear example of government waste. But look, the film demonstrates something else as well, and that is how far science fiction has worked its way into the popular imagination. It was once the refuge of geeks and outcasts, but in the past few decades, shows like Star Trek have paved the way to a rich culture of science fiction fandom. And one of the men who helped spread that joy of science fiction is Jim Mintz. He is now the senior editor and director of subsidiary rights at Bain Publishing in Wake Forest, and he spent his career shepherding sci-fi writers to the bookstores from a variety of publishing houses. Jim Mintz joins us now on The State of Things. Welcome, Jim. Good to have you here.
It's good to be back.
Did you hear about that Star Trek spoof before?
Yeah, actually I had. I'd never actually heard any clips from it before, but I'm aware of it. Yeah, there's a whole slew of great Trek stuff from both produced professionally and by fans.
As somebody who publishes sci-fi, did you hear about that and say, see, we've arrived?
as a matter of fact, it's been a number of years now where I've been saying SF has been taking over the world. It's interesting to see whether you look at the mass media, you look at the movie and film, all the top grossing films are science fiction or fantasy related. But even beyond that, we all have, you know, much better communicator than Kirk ever had, and it's sitting in our pocket right now. Granted, it doesn't have the same kind of range. We aren't talking in outer space as far as we know, but still, you know, life has become very science fiction, even as the culture's become, it's become much more of the norm. One of those real signature movies that helped change that actually was The Matrix. It was the first time, while it was a great action adventure story, after that really wicked cool opening set piece, there was 45 minutes of talking heads basically explaining all we are is a battery to some, you know, machine overlord. And that is one heck of a high-end science fiction concept, something that if you'd have tried explaining that to someone even from the 50s or even 60s, unless they were a true SF geek, would have been looking at you like you were crazy. And now that's a baseline that everybody understands. And so high-end science fictional concepts are much more easy to swallow because of the popular culture.
Well, I was just going to say, what is it that accounts for that? Because those high-end concepts, one way or another, have driven our imagination. What are we? What are we? Somebody else's dream, this whole sort of thing that animates science fiction culture. And yet, even though that's been at the root of our deepest philosophical questions forever, sci-fi hasn't been as popular. What do you think sort of accounts for the change in the popular imagination, the digestibility of sci-fi over such a broad spectrum of consumers?
I think that a lot of it has to do with the simple intrusion of technology into people's lives. Life obviously has gotten a lot more complicated and diverse. Communities are able to find each other through technology. And so, you know, the ability to find other people. And the neat thing about it is, while this actually applies to science fiction geeks, it certainly applies to any other kind of geek, using the term generally. You've got some subject matter, whether it's quilting or the Green Bay Packers, whatever. You can find your fellow fans out there, and the use of technology actually helps you do that. And the more technology becomes endemic to people's lives, the more you're able to explain more difficult, more deep concepts to them and try and get them to buy into that notion. It kind of actually goes back to J.R.R. Tolkien in The Lord of the Rings. He's the guy who first said in his essay on fairy stories, a good escapist fiction is going to be trying to create what he called second belief so that the people actually believe in that world. Obviously, you know, urban fantasy and things like that have a big step up because it's borrowing from our world. But even with science fiction that's from the far future, there's still that usually fundamental base of, you know, our own world and our own culture.
How did you get involved in this? How did you get interested?
Well, for me, a lot of it started with The Lord of the Rings. I was a young boy, youngest of six kids, had five older siblings. The oldest brother bought my second oldest brother The Lord of the Rings for Christmas, and I yearned for those books mightily. I was only in the third grade at the time, and I pilfered them at the first chance I had and worked my way through them and never looked back.
Good Catholic boy like you stealing from your brother?
Well, borrowed. I started them first, therefore I got to read them first, even though I had to be, squirreling away in my closet reading at the beginning so I could be far enough in to say, hey, I'm already 100 pages in. You can't take it away now.
Tell us about that. Growing up Catholic in West Bend, Wisconsin, a community, as I said earlier, most famous for its small appliances.
That's right. As a matter of fact, our small claim to fame, if you ever watched game shows in the 70s and 80s, you probably saw them as consolation prizes, the pots and pans, popcorn poppers, and the like. And, it was a typical Midwestern town. I'd like to say we had both kinds of folks. We had German Catholics and German Lutherans in my hometown. Along with the small community of Hmong who had been moved in after the Vietnam War from Laos. But that really was the only minority population in my hometown. And, and that's just because the Germans settled there. It was beautiful, lush, green country, great place for farming. So a lot of Bavarians, a lot of Bohemians, and I do mean that literally, people from Bohemia. Not the other kind of Bohemians, although certainly the first things the Germans do is build their breweries and then they start farming.
And then they go to Lambeau Field.
Exactly.
Kind of act out a little. But there you are, two kinds of people, the German Catholic and German Lutherans, which is to say a provincial kind of a town.
Absolutely.
Now you're in third grade reading Lord of the Rings and allowed to have this second imagination or this second world open up to you. What did that do for you?
Well, I always was interested in exploring, the best of fiction explores who you are and what you are. And both fantasy and science fiction allows you to do things perhaps more than what general fiction can, because you can posit a type of world that isn't likely, and yet it helps you explore a certain aspect of the human condition. So being able to, not to mention, of course, there's just the pure thrill of a world where there's black and white, good versus evil. You know the good guys wear the white hats, and it's something that appeals to people on a fundamental level. Nobody ever went broke writing about heroes, going all the way back to Gilgamesh and Enkidu and Homer and the Odyssey and the rest. And looking for heroes probably more than anything. I was the youngest of six, which means, much like in the military, crap rolls downhill. So it doesn't matter who was having a bad day. Sometimes I was having a bad day as a result. And so I tended to find myself reading a lot. Take me places I couldn't go anywhere. I also had the older brothers, who meant I did get involved with playing sports, reading sports. I'm of that very small overlap in the Venn diagram of both hardcore sports fan and hardcore SF geek. There aren't a lot of us.
Well, was there any tension in the household? I mean, did you become a kind of an apparent geek playing in fantasy games, which in a sports household might have marked you as an outsider?
Well, I was lucky in that my older brothers also were into the stuff, not to the level I was. I always had my nose in the book. I was an avid reader, and fantasy and science fiction is what I gravitated towards for the most part, although read plenty of Ellery Queen mysteries and Hardy Boy mysteries. Never carried much for Nancy Drew, feel forgive me. I was more of a Hardy Boys guy. But, I always had my nose in the fantasy and science fiction book. That being said, West Bend was only about an hour and 10 minutes from Lake Geneva, where Dungeons & Dragons was first created by TSR Gary Gygax in 1976, I believe was the year. And I went to Gen Con through most of my youth, from 1978 to 96, even into my adulthood. And so I had brothers who were into role-playing games and doing that sort of thing. And even now we occasionally hop on an MMO and game together. Lord of the Rings Online is our favorite.
And you, at one point, had thought you wanted to be a Catholic priest.
Yeah, actually, I grew up very devout Catholic household. Like many Catholic schoolboys, yes, I was going to grow up to be a priest. But actually, I considered it very seriously as a vocation. I had strong faith. I looked at we had some great priests in my local church, Holy Angels Parish in West Bend. I thought they were just the most wonderful men. They were both affable and great with family. They were caring about the community, very big supporters. And so that was something I did aspire to. And so going through Catholic grade school, I even applied to St. Lawrence Seminary and was seriously considering going on to the priesthood for quite some time. And so, yes, I was reading fantasy and science fiction, but I also read the Bible a couple of times before I even got to high school, and even read histories of the Catholic Church, histories of the saints. I took it to that next level of I'm a geek. I geeked out about the Catholic faith as well.
Well, as a fellow Catholic, there's an obvious joke to make here about Catholicism, sci-fi, and fantasy. But I'm going to get right past that joke to get to the ultimate concern here, which is just that people who are interested in a priesthood religious ideas or science fiction and fantasy, notice that humans are good at symbolic thinking, that that's what distinguishes us from other beasts. And that kind of symbolic thinking brings you to ultimate causes and ultimate effects pretty easily. And so in a very serious way, these two ideas seem to me to be wonderfully married.
Yeah, absolutely. It is about exploring the human condition. And on a fundamental level, the church and its good works have been a part of that for a long, long time.
Well, Jim Mintz, I want to talk to you some more about that. Your journey to become a sci-fi publisher at Bain Publishing, take you through the wilds of suburban Milwaukee and out to Wake Forest. Yeah. When I'm talking with Jim Mintz today on the State of Things, more of our conversation from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking with Jim Mintz, senior editor and director of subsidiary rights at Bain Publishing in Wake Forest. But, you know, it would seem a pretty simple shot. A guy is interested in fantasy and sci-fi as a young man, thinks briefly about the priesthood, but ends up in Wake Forest at Bain Publishing. You're laughing. Not so. You go to college and kind of the bottom drops out. But tell us about those years, what you recall of it.
Well, I was going to high school in the 80s and I was a math and science whiz. There wasn't a standardized test I didn't get a perfect score on, from Iowa Basics on up through the ACT, SAT. So I was pushed towards the engineering track, even though I was sitting in the back of these math and science classes reading my fantasy and science fiction novels and ignoring the teachers. And I took the math and science classes, really enjoyed them. The theory was certainly more interesting. Then I got to the engineering actual core curriculum and discovered I didn't want to be able to regurgitate numbers like a CAD program for a living. We kind of had to part for irreconcilable differences. It was an interesting beginning to my college career. I had three semesters of, you know, dean's list, dean's list, dean's list. Then it was, you know, I withdrew, then I dropped out, and then I got kicked out, and eventually I settled back in at Letters and Sciences and went for an English degree, which was a little different.
Well, it is, because you were, again, kind of you're brilliant at math, but it sounds like engineering, math application wasn't quite it for you.
Yeah.
Now you find yourself in the humanities.
Yeah, it was very different. It was actually very liberating. I'd always enjoyed school because I was good at school, and as the youngest of six, I liked to show off and show up my older brother. So there was the aspect where I liked school because I was smart. But when I left engineering and came back after a year and a half and could take anything I wanted in a broad humanities program at the University of Wisconsin, I did. I took class on classic mythology, folklore, psychology, anything that caught my eye. I ended up graduating with 160 credits for a 120 degree credit program.
Wow. In English and philosophy?
I had a degree in English with minor equivalents in German, math, and philosophy.
German, math, and philosophy.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
It's a lot for a guy. And by the way, we should go back, because this is even funnier, because that year and a half that you just glossed over, pretty rough year and a half for you. or a lot of fun.
Rough on my liver, perhaps. I worked. One of the ways I paid for college and why I was actually fairly flush with cash is I did asbestos abatement. And at the time, a lot of that work was on schools. I mean, it was mandated to get the stuff out of schools because that's long-term exposure is the only real hazard there. And so I worked about 7 months of that year and a half and spent the rest of the time having a good time, funding the drinking habits of a couple of dart league teams, followed the Grateful Dead for a month or so, visited my sister over the Pacific Northwest for a month. Had a lot of fun. On the other hand, you know, there was time to get back to life and work and figuring out what the heck I wanted to do with myself.
What was it about? I guess you grew up in this German community.
Yeah.
So did you grow up speaking German? Did you know the language very well?
I grew up being tortured by German speakers. My hometown, actually, when I grew up as a kid, there was still one Catholic church that did actually have a service in German every Sunday. I kind of went away by the time I went to high school. But I had older siblings who were studying German. And one of my favorite games for my sisters was Bist du eine, which is R-U-A. And they would ask us questions in German. Bist du eine? And I won't say some of the things they said. And we'd have to say yes or no, ja oder nein. And, you know, it didn't matter what we answered. They would laugh at us about it. So there was an inclination.
Because you needed a pretty good collection of nouns not to say something silly about yourself.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And And the thing about it too is, and we even had little sayings around the house that were in German, and you know, little crochet things and little placards that had German sayings, Gott in Himmel and the rest.
None of that helped you in the German class, though.
No. But my high school had a terrific German program. I placed in a fifth semester German into college, which is kind of the reason I went for German. And in fact, I had used up all my free electives if I would have gone after the engineering degree by simply taking one class in German in college.
Wow.
And then when I went back, I needed to declare a major, and I went ahead and declared German because that's what I had enough credits. And I didn't want to go theoretical math. I didn't see life in academia, which is really about the only route to go if you go theory. So I declared a German degree, and I went in, took a literature class, German literature written actually in German, but it had been 4 years since I'd even spoken a word of it. I struggled with the actual language. On the other hand, unlike a lot of the other participants, I did actually treat it like a lit class and talked about crazy things like plot and setting and theme and rest.
And this was something that your professor kind of liked, the idea that you weren't just good at Dubinstein.
My grade in that class was absolutely a gift for the fact that I was the only kid in the class who treated it like a lit class.
You were having to talk in English about the great themes.
I'll admit, I was greatly benefited by the fact that the University of Wisconsin has the largest collection of German literature and translation in the United States. I may have read a few things, although I will say this, Kafka is definitely better in the original German, but the rest I kind of have read English.
Who were your favorite authors, and what were some of the themes and ideas that you were drawn to?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, German literature has a strong history with Romanticism, and that's something that's obviously always appealed to me, and that's certainly rife in fantasy literature as well. And you get into some of the more, you know, the Expressionist movement. I mean, obviously the German arts from the, you know, 19th, 20th centuries were very much formative to a lot of other cultures, bringing up a lot of the more modern movements, things that I actually am not as big a fan of personally. On the other hand, I appreciate it from an historical perspective and the fact that they were pushing boundaries. On the other hand, I don't care where you hang a commode. It's still just a toilet. It's not art.
Yeah.
So I'm not a big modern art fan. On the other hand, I appreciate the stretching boundaries that way.
So now you've got these degrees and lots of credits in German, in engineering, in math, I should say, and in some in philosophy, right?
Yeah.
At any point along the way, had you concocted a plan what you were going to do with all this?
Not in the least. I have to admit, I lucked out. My last year in school, which would be about 8 years after I began. Yes, there are a lot of people that have degrees after 8 years. They're called doctors and lawyers. But,
yeah.
But I did take a little bit of time off. But that being said, my last year in school, because I was actually an English philosophy major at the time, it meant that at a campus of over 42,000 students, I had the exact same five classes as another English philosophy double major by the name of John Klima. And thanks to Plato, I ended up getting into publishing. We had an ancient philosophy class, and the teacher met with the students on a two-on-one basis, doing a tutorial. He would lecture. He wouldn't tell you about the material you're going to be tested on. You took a take-home test on the stuff he was going to spend the next 6 weeks lecturing. Very Platonic in its approach. And so he would meet with the students and explain how wrong your answers were in a two-on-one session. So you'd be dressed down, but then you'd see him do it to another student. And he was very kind with the grades because he wanted you to think for yourself. That was the point. But for my first session, the professor didn't make it. John Klein was sitting there reading this fantasy novel. I started talking to him about it, and he got me an internship where he was working with a fellow by the name of James Frankel. And Jim's the guy who got me into publishing.
Tell me more about Jim Frankel.
Well, he's an interesting guy. Works now. He's still on the staff at Tor Books now. When I was working for him, he was actually a freelancer working on Tor Books. But Jim had been on the New York scene for more than 20 years, and had decided that, you know, he'd had the ability to be able to work as a consultant from anywhere.
Tor Books Sci-Fi?
Now, Tor Books is the number one publisher of fantasy and science fiction. They've been rated that by Locus, which is the trade magazine for SF publishing. They've been number one for at least 18 years. They may even be up to 20 years by now. I kind of lost track because they always get the title for good reason. And so, you know, they're the number one publisher in the English language for the number of titles, number of bestsellers, whatever measure you want to look. They're pretty much at the top. And Jim was doing consulting work, working on a book-by-book basis. But because, of course, he was only getting paid per project, we were doing a lot of other things. It was a really great place to learn about publishing because he was also representing a number of authors that were, you know, strong enough to be published, but perhaps not strong enough to crack that Torah list, which is a very prestigious list. And so he was working as a literary agent, also doing some print advertising for Carolyn Graff, because that was a regular money cash cow. We were packaging the year's best fantasy and horror, edited by Datlow and Windling at the time. So I got to do a lot of different things.
And you were doing all these things as well.
Yes, as his assistant. I mean, the job was almost more office manager, in that I sat there at my desk paying attention, overseeing interns who had came into business like I did. And then Jim would be on the phone promising something to somebody on some project that I'd make sure that happened. It was sometimes like herding cats because there were so many things going on. But, you know, it was a great place to learn about almost every aspect of the business.
Well, what about it? Because you were obviously a big fan of science fiction and fantasy by then. But, you know, it's sometimes, as they say, watching the sausage made, you know, makes you lose your appetite.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm still a huge fan of fantasy and science fiction. But, you know, I read more books before I got in the business. I mean, that's not literally true, but I read more published books before I got in the business. I read a lot of manuscripts. I see a lot of stuff that's not up to snuff. On the other hand, you know, every editor's hope and dream is to sit there and find that book that makes you want to knock it off your train at the next stop. That's, you know, New York-based as most publishing is in New York City. You think of the manuscript you're reading that makes you want to say, you know what, I wish I didn't have to get off the train and stop reading. And you're still looking for that as a fan.
So it's rough when you start to read all the stuff that didn't get published, I guess.
Yeah, Yeah. I mean, they talk about the ebook revolution, and we don't need editors and publishers anymore. And I just laugh because a few years of reading what would equivalent of what a slush pile is, stuff that's not edited, not agented, just anybody putting it out there, will make you yearn to have somebody out there as an arbiter of taste saying, no, don't pay attention to all that drack.
Yeah.
Here's the one in a thousand that's actually worth reading, and that number might be generous.
Well, had you entertained fantasies of writing this kind of stuff before this?
I've never had the urge to really be a writer, at least not in that sense. I like to tell stories, but I like to tell stories over a nice cold one. And when it comes to writing, I like to write op-ed pieces. I've written a few letters to the New York Times, but I think that's about all I've ever had published.
We talk about science fiction was first fandom, and then that paved the way for what you see as many of the fan communities that we're now pretty familiar with.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, just last week, a wonderful, wonderful person and a terrific writer by the name of Paul Williams passed away. And he was a science fiction fan with a capital F. And in the 50s and 60s, he was involved with producing what they call fanzines, you know, not professional, you know, we're talking the old mimeograph machines, sending out 50 of these to your friends, talking about the latest science fiction novel that you really love. And from that, Paul got the idea of starting to do rock and roll reporting. He started a fanzine called Crawdaddy, which was the precursor to the Rolling Stone and all the rest. Rock and roll journalism was born out of SF fandom. And indeed, that's true for a lot of others. On the other hand, SF fandom also has to, you know, tip a hat to the, you know, fan regs that were being produced for early film and radio and things like that as well. It's a continuum.
Yeah. I mean, certainly celebrity fandom had preceded or at least grown in tandem with that. But also there's a kind of knowledge base that fans have. And this may be particularly true in science fiction and fantasy, where often we find series of books that have long histories and everybody's got to pay attention, including the author and publisher.
Yeah. Yeah. It's daunting to work into a field where, you know, there's people out there who've read it all. I mean, I was always quite envious of my first two bosses in the business. Both Jim Frankel and David Hartwell grew up at a time when you could literally read every word of fantasy and science fiction that was being published. Whereas, you know, if you read every moment of every day of your life now, unless you literally were the fastest reader in the world, I don't think it'd be possible to read all the fantasy and science fiction that's being published. But there are those fans out there that do indeed dedicate much of their free time to reading this stuff, and they know it better than you do inside and out. Even the authors face that prospect. Nothing like writing an extremely complicated future history, and just like you see with a Star Trek fan saying, well, you know, that tricorder that he used in that, I mean,
that's right.
Yeah, these are our fans, and we love them, and without them, we wouldn't have a business. On the other hand, it means you are, you know, and we may be making this stuff up, but you got to be consistent about
it. Well, and that has led to some pretty interesting collaborations with fans among publishers and writers, right?
Absolutely. And in fact, there's a long history of writers coming out of fandom. I mean, any number of guys who were started by writing letters in fanzines who went on to become SF grandmasters stretching back 50, 60 years. People like Fred Pohl and the rest who started the Futurians in New York in the 40s. And, you know, there's a – and throughout, all the way up to a number of our authors who are in New York Times bestsellers who began – you know, some of them wrote fan fiction, like Lois McMaster Bujold as a teen wrote fan fiction for, oh, I don't even remember what teen drama she was a fan of back then. But now she's a multiple award-winning author. And even now, we even have our best-selling author is David Weber. He's got a series called The Honorverse, Honor Harrington's This Hero. He basically set out to write a series of future history with space navies where he could borrow the best from naval history, best from U.S. naval history in the 19th and 20 or 18th and 19th century, best from the British naval history, 18th, 19th century, and build a future space naval. And that was the basic concept. It's now 17 novels long, spanning multiple intergalactic empires. And David's got a whole crew of people who help him keep track of how that works. They call themselves Bureau 9, which borrows from the internal reference to the series. Yeah. And they call themselves Bureau 9, and they actually help David make sure he doesn't make mistakes. So much so that we're even publishing a quote-unquote nonfiction companion volume to the Honorverse explaining all this stuff.
Because they've got Excel sheets with all this stuff mapped out and graphics and the whole thing so that you can't lose track. Can you write a book? I mean, when you think of fans, of course, you think of numbers of people. Yeah. Are there committees? Are there fan groups who can actually get together and if not write and form an entire novel or a series?
I think that the biggest reference to that would actually be another series of ours. We have an alternate history called The Ring of Fire, also often shorthand referred to as the 1632 series. Eric Flint created with the basic concept that you take a contemporary West Virginia mining town and throw it back through history and time into the middle of Germany in the year 1632 during the 30 Years' War, some of the darkest history in European history, bloodiest time, where you know basically it was mostly a bunch of roving armies looking for a fight in order to survive, looting and pillaging. And what happens when a bunch of can-do Americans say, wait a minute, people have rights too, and how that throws all the political alliances askew. And Eric, of course, wanted to rigorously develop this. So he was like, well, okay, now how are they going to make bullets for their guns? Well, obviously, it's not the people who are the miners because they need the advanced equipment. The really important guy is the silversmith because he knows how to work with the hand tools and knows the alloys on a field basis without all the high technology. Now, he's not going to be a main character out of this series, but he's important. So somebody decided, you know, the guy who actually helped him develop the tech and work all this stuff out, then wrote a short story about it. And there's to the point where they call it the Granville Gazette. We're up to, I think, issue number 44 now, published in e-text only. And Granville's the name of the town. And this is the fictional magazine telling the stories of all the minor characters while Eric's busily writing the main novels with all the big politics and everything else. And there's a community of over 200 writers at this point who've contributed to it, both technically and professionally. And, you know, there are three different people who actually know Eric's world much better than he does. One of them's called Paula Goodlett. We call her the butcher of Granville because she's the one who does the editing on the magazine.
I see.
And then there's Virginia DeMars, and she's the historian. And that's literal. And this is all, of course, fictional history, yet they know it inside and out.
So tell us more about your story because you're working with Jim Frankel, but this is still Wisconsin. You eventually go to New York. Tell us about that transition.
Well, I worked for Jim first for almost a year as an intern, and then I was a paid assistant for about 3 years. And then a job opening came up on a tour, and I was, of course, on the phone every day with Tor about Tor business, consulting on their books and stuff. And I was busily calling former interns of mine who seemed like they had the publishing bug, because if you have the publishing bug, it's a great business to be in. On the other hand, the pay is terrible, and it's based in New York City. So unless you love books and want to be a pauper, it's not a great career choice. But that being said, people who I knew had the bug and wanted to be in publishing. And while I was making these calls, my wife's like, well, why aren't you applying for this job in New York? And I kind of looked at her and said, well, what are you, nuts? Because it wasn't going to be like a big bump in pay. And as I said, it's New York City based. We had a very nice 3-bedroom, 2.5-bath townhouse for a pittance that wouldn't have gotten us a closet in Manhattan. And that being said, my wife luckily was working in banking, and she also was able to find a job. And so I went legit. Bottom line is, if I really wanted to be in publishing, I did need to be in New York-based. What I was saying to these interns was true for me as well. Jim was a great boss. It was a great opportunity. But unless I was going to be his assistant the rest of my career, I needed to go to New York and be in the business.
So you worked for Del Rey?
No. Well, actually, I went to Tor first. Oh. So I worked on Tor books on a freelance basis for about 4 years. And then I was at Tor for actually about 8. And then Random House came knocking. Delray's the SF imprint there, and they wanted me to come over and work on that imprint. And, well, Random House is the top dog, biggest publisher in the world, best salaries, best benefits, had a great view of the Hudson, could see the Intrepid from my window.
You're not there anymore. Let's talk about that, but first we'll take a break. My guest is Jim Mincy, senior editor and director of subsidiary rights at Bain Publishing in Wake Forest, North Carolina. We'll talk more about Bain Publishing and how that led the charge in the brave new world of e-publishing, and hear more about Jim's career as we continue on the State of Things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Jim Mintz. He is senior editor and director of subsidiary rights at Bain Publishing in Wake Forest. Now, you're in Wisconsin for a while. You're doing publishing there. You leave the land of brats and beer. You go to New York, the big house. You're at Random House now. How's that going?
The fact of the matter is that Random House wasn't necessarily a good fit for me. It's a terrific company. It's the largest publisher in the world. And because it has thousands of employees, it needs to have a structure in place. And from day one, when I worked with Jim Frankel, my whole career was about sticking my nose into all the different nooks and crannies and make sure stuff got done. Now, the fact of the matter is when you're running a company that big, people need to fit into their slots. I was a very square peg trying to fit in a round hole. I have some good friends from my time there, and it was a great experience. There's some books that came out of there I'm quite proud of. But it was never a good fit because it needed to be a corporate environment, and I'm not a corporate type. That's not really who I am.
Yeah, they had to kind of stay put and not work on, worry about somebody's rights and how they're, you know.
Exactly. I'd want to worry about trying to stick my nose and ask if there's anything I could do with subsidiary rights, and subsidiary rights are like, well, we know what we're doing. You gave us what we needed. And, you know, even things like contracts where I'd say, well, you know, maybe we should be thinking about adjusting contract language. Well, obviously you don't suggest that to your bosses, even if it made sense. I mean, I'm not in contracts, not my job. And I get it. I mean, that's the way they needed to be, but that also meant that it wasn't the kind of place I wanted to be. I'd like to stick my nose in. If I've got a good idea, I'd like to share it.
So tell us about how you got to Wake Forest and Bain Publishing.
Well, that's just after Random House and I parted ways. I was on the hunt for a job, and it just so happened that Bain Books was looking to hire somebody. So I kind of lucked into it. I actually was still based around New York at the time I got hired, and I was at my place up in New Jersey. And we were looking for new office spaces down here at the time, still in the Wake Forest area. So I kind of worked from home for the first couple of years while we got new office space, and I actually had an office down here. And then I came down and made the move. And it's been great. You know, I swapped out basically the largest corporate Uber structure in all of publishing for Tony Weisskopf, who's our publisher, and which means that I can get a straight answer, and I'm talking to somebody who gets it. I mean, she comes out of fandom. She was going to SF conventions as a teenager before she ever worked in publishing. And here's somebody who's, you know, better read than I am. I always like that because, you know, you need to have that appreciation of where your fiction comes from and who your fans are. And so it's wonderful having a boss like that.
But the obvious critique is that fans don't necessarily make good business people.
Oh, no, not at all. In fact, there's any number of people coming out of fandom who've gotten into publishing where it wasn't a good fit. And indeed, that is probably at its core of what didn't work for me at Random House, in that I'm a geek. I want to know everything. I want to stick my nose in everything. I want to figure it all out. You know, from the outsider perspective, how do you do these things? I don't want to just be stuck in this is what I'm supposed to do. And you have that aspect where, yes, it's not necessarily a good fit.
So you've got people who know both the business end. We'll talk about Jim Bain, who founded Bain Publishing, because here's somebody who gets business but in his own way and was way ahead of his time.
Yeah. Well, Jim, you know, had a fascinating career. He started out in the complaints department. I think it was at Galaxy magazine. I might be getting the wrong magazine there. So he was basically answering letters from people who were complaining, and in such a way that actually got him the attention to be brought up into editorial, which is only person I know of to make that leap.
Now, are these people who are complaining about the inconsistencies?
Absolutely. Got it. These are the people who are writing and complaining about, well, inconsistencies in the fiction, and also, of course, writing in and complaining about, you know, some of the essays and other things like that as well. Although that's the letters department separate, but still, it kind of depends on how it's being worded, whether it's intended to be published or not, versus the just plain complaining about what somebody wrote.
Yeah.
And from there, Jim, you know, edited in magazines. Then he became a book editor. And as a matter of fact, he was the first editor-in-chief for Tor Books when Tom Doherty started the company in 1980. And then in 1982, Simon & Schuster came knocking and said to Jim, hey, why don't you start an imprint for us? And his counteroffer was, hey, why don't I start my own publishing company and you can distribute it? And I could kiss them for that choice, because that means we don't have corporate Uber bosses. We get to play with the big boys. Simon & Schuster's our distributor. We get, you know, the full-on might and of the distribution and marketing that that means. But we aren't answerable to a corporate P&L for the entire division. We simply have to take care of ourselves, which is a wonderful thing.
Still a bold move. Big company comes to you like that. Yeah. It must sound attractive. And, of course, their answer is, why don't you just?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, right.
But instead, they bid and said, well, this guy must know his stuff, so we will distribute, and that's a good deal for them.
Yep, absolutely. And, indeed, the publishing model these days while we're seeing some of the corporate mergers and all that sort of thing, there's also a desire to find worthwhile products to distribute, because it helps you justify the extra warehouse space and all the rest of the stuff, and helps meet your bottom line for distribution deals. But back then, there weren't that many distribution deals going on. It was kind of forward thinking even then. And of course, that spilled over into the ebook business. I mean, you know, Bain has always been a traditional publisher, hardcover, trade paperback, mass market books. That's what we produce. On the other hand, as soon as the ebook revolution started, and I was in the business at a time when, of course, when Peanut Press started it for the Palm Pilot, the first ebooks that were ever created in the 90s, this was going to shake the world. And of course, it's finally happening 16 years later. But Jim, you know, got it from a very early stage. It's like, well, guess what? This is a cheap way to put text in front of people. This is a great thing. And he started by putting like CD-ROMs in the back of hardcovers, where you'd buy a hardcover, a bestseller, and in the back would be a bunch of free books from authors you never even heard of. Because for general trade fiction publishing, the biggest problem for literally, all right, I'm going to be conservative and say only 95% of the authors, but the real number is probably 99 point something. The real problem isn't that somebody wants to steal your book. The real problem is finding anybody who wants to take the time to bother reading it in the first place.
Well, therein lies the real the revolution in his thinking and the innovation, I guess, and ingenuity. Everybody else in existing businesses, music and book publishing, is saying, okay, we get that it's an easy way to distribute, but how do we get people to pay for this and how do we protect people's rights? Jim Bain says, that's not the problem. The problem is what you just described. Right. And he starts giving stuff away. But I would then argue, yeah, but then how are you going to get paid? And he figured that out too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and while I think that the recording industry is definitely a cautionary tale for publishers, and there are certainly similarities in the model in general, there's a big difference in that the diversity and the number of titles published by a big publisher with thousands and thousands of new books every year actually dwarfs what you're going to see out of recording industries, at least at the big houses, where they're trying to market and push the big names that they're trying to do, which is an element of publishing, but it's not quite the same thing. But that being said, Jim got it at a very early age. One of the things we started doing, we've been our own ebook retailer on a website base for over 13 years already. And one of the things we created very early on was the Bain Free Library, which is still in existence today. And what it is about 100 or so free ebooks. You want to come to our website, Bain.com. That's BAEN.com. Pardon the shill. But the free library has over 100 titles absolutely free. Just so happens a lot of them are first, maybe even second books in a 10-book series, because if you try it out and you like it, you're going to come back and get it. And then, of course, the other real key innovation from Jim's point of view was that we made them cheap and affordable at the time. We've had to bow to certain market forces and the fact that we've got multiple people distributing our ebooks. Our ebooks have come up for price in recent years because we're now distributing them with others, not just selling them ourselves. But still, we had a very aggressive low price point for new ebooks, because if you make it cheap and easy and treat your customers like customers, they'll come to you. And we, you know, when I first came to Bain, there was a regular flow of letters, fan letters saying, you know, I don't even read fantasy and science fiction, but I love the fact that you guys, we don't use encryption. We don't try and make it difficult, because we aren't going to assume you want to rip us off. We're going to assume you want to buy our books because you like our books. And if you start with that fundamental idea, people react well to it.
Well, again, you're not using proprietary formats and encryption and other things, which means I could just hand it to the next guy, I guess.
Absolutely.
The next reader. But that doesn't seem to have cut into your profits.
Well, I'm pretty sure we aren't printing books with disappearing ink either. passing along books to your friends is doing us a favor. Ripping off whole lists. I mean, we do send out, you know, if you want to really get in the technical jargon, we send out our DMCA takedown requests when we find our fiction on other websites, even stuff we're giving away in the free library because, yes, it's copyright material. Yes, we protect it. So, you know, that request will go out with a, hey, we're glad you're fans. Why don't you point people to our site where they can get it for free anyway? But the bottom line is, well, there's a few ideas here. Number one, the reason why encryption for general trade fiction, this isn't proprietary education where you're paying experts to develop stuff and this is information only a select people want. That I get you might want to encrypt and protect because it's a select audience thing. But for general trade fiction to a broad audience, if somebody wants to steal your ebook, they will. I mean, it was, I think, the second Harry Potter existed as a PDF long before ebooks were really popular, within 24 hours of it being published because somebody dropped into a scanner and sent it out there. If somebody wants to steal that ebook, they're going to. Now, the real key here is with ebooks, unlike physical product, it's not actually costing you anything until you spend money to try and stop it. Now you've incurred a cost. Now, don't get me wrong. We don't want people stealing our books. Right. But that being said, if they want to steal your book, you're not going to stop them. They're also never going to be your customer. They're not going to give you money. They're not going to give you money. So spending money to try and stop encryption is a joke. When I go to these giant trade shows, Book Expo America and the rest, and I hear somebody touting the latest and greatest and unbreakable encryption, it just makes me laugh because there is no such thing.
Right, right. Well, and as you point out, it's pretty easy to hand a good book to a good friend.
Exactly.
And then that book can make its way through and then ultimately be sold, which I guess you wouldn't do with an ebook. I can't sell it to a secondary.
Well, yeah. Well, you. Yeah. That's when you would be breaking the law for right. Sure. I mean, DMCA right. requests and the rest. Yeah. But there are people out there who have tried that with remote sites and things like that.
Of course, the other big fear is that with e-publishing, the book industry, the publishing industry itself would go away. That's not happening either, is it?
Well, yeah. It's an interesting issue. I mean, the publishing industry in the last 2-3 years is going through some rather fundamental shakedowns. And the industry as a whole for general trade fiction has shrunk precipitously. Now, at Bain, because we were ahead of the game with ebooks and have been selling our own for 13 years, we've had any kind of amortization on the print books where people who are only going to buy ebook already is there. So other publishers are experiencing that shrinkage of physical book audience and how many physical books they're putting out there. But the bottom line is literacy rates are an all-time high. And if we can get books, make them cheap and affordable, and put them anywhere, great. I mean, one of the biggest problems with the publishing industry is we've lost physical distribution to a lot of places through different channels. You no longer have wire racks in hotels selling cheap paperbacks. You no longer have wire racks in Five and Dime. I'll bore you the speech about what happened with with wholesale distribution. That's a long talk. But the bottom line is ebooks is a way to get back to those people. When somebody's phone is an easy way and a pleasurable way to read a book, I've just gained billions of customers that I didn't have access to otherwise.
Well, the other thing, and I just heard this in a commentary recently, is that what e-publishing is doing is not in the way that television didn't eliminate radio and HBO didn't end the movie industry. They just force each of those industries to be more conscious of what they do best, and now they're doing that.
Absolutely. And there is the issue of, obviously, I mean, 100 years ago, books were one of the only forms of entertainment. Therefore, they had a monopoly, and that certainly aided them in their abilities to do that. And the fact of the matter is that there are lots of things competing for the entertainment dollar, which does hurt in a sense. On the other hand, if you make it cheap, affordable, and easy, people who like to read will read. And also the nice thing about this modern age, and this is something, again, Jim Bain got at a very early age, there's the ability to reach the long tail. Long before the term long tail existed or was coined, Jim Bain had started up the Bain's Bar, which is an online chat room, which has migrated different technologies over the last 15 years. And we get fan feedback. And indeed, it's informed what we've published. And in fact, we even have long before other publishers introduced similar ideas, we had a slush pile of people who could submit and have our fans provide feedback to them. And in fact, New York Times bestseller John Ringo came out of that process, guy who got feedback from Bain fans about new fiction he was writing, learned a bit more about writing because he was just a military vet who always loved Heinlein, decided to write stuff, and got some great feedback and developed his career and actually came out of that.
Well, that leads us to this the news last week that Amazon is buying Goodreads, again, a way for people to talk about what they read and spread the joy of reading to other people. Now, Amazon owns it. They're putting some restrictions on their editorial commentary, and people are worried that this might happen with Goodreads as well.
Yeah, that well, certainly that's something to be concerned about. But the bottom line is, and it goes back to, one of the things that happened with the ebook revolution now is, of course, a number of writers, especially frustrated writers who haven't been published, haven't found somebody who wants to acquire their fiction and put it out there, are saying, ha-ha, we don't need those publishers anymore. And yet the fact of the matter is, trust me, you want us standing there going through trying to find stuff that's worthwhile. Having a recognizable brand name for a publisher is going to be more meaningful. I think bigger publishers that publish everything are going to have a more difficult time in this environment because readers will recognize what a Bane book is. Bane is, strong, action-driven, plot-driven story with heroes you can root for. That's what we do. We aren't looking for the next great literary experiment that blurs genres, none of that kind of stuff. Other publishers do that, do it well. But people know what a Bane book is. Therefore, we have a brand recognition, and that works well for us. I think things like Goodreads, and one of the more interesting things that may come out of the ebook industry is, having a reliable arbiter of taste. Will that always be publishers? Well, I think publishers are always going to have a role in that, but I also think that forward-thinking critic, somebody who can figure out a way to monetize their ability to identify worthwhile fiction for readers, that could be a model that would actually produce money for a whole new group. Critics who actually can make money by references.
And
obviously Amazon's trying to do that writ large.
Well, that's writ large is their MO. But the experience is also a big part of reading. So when you go to Quail Ridge in Raleigh and Flyleaf in Chapel Hill and the Regulator in Durham and McIntyre's, up at Farrington, that's an experience that you can't have any other way, and people will still gravitate to that.
Yeah. Hardcore readers are always going to be there. But the nice thing about the ebook revolution is it'll get us to people who don't think of themselves as readers, because with all the mall stores that have closed, with loss of wire racks everywhere, there are the casual reader who never thinks to go to a bookstore as a destination. Those are the people who are going to reach with ebooks that I'm excited about. But yeah, that's always going to be part of the core experience. And I think that even now I've got nephews and nieces who are avid readers and they much prefer physical books. I've got an 8-year-old who devours books. Not to tout too much, but she was reading The Chronicles of Narnia before kindergarten. She scares me a little.
There you go. She's going to have your
job,
Jim.
But she wants physical books.
Jim, good to talk with you. Jim Mintz, Senior Editor and Director of Subsidiary Rights at Bain Publishing in Wake Forest. For more information, you can go to Bain, BAEN.com. Our website, of course, stateofthings.org, a program directed by Alec Granados and produced by Isaac Davey Aronson, Sean Wen, and Nicole Campbell. Christina Blides, the intern. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf, the news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.